Yeah, what are you doing today?
Mudlarking.
What is mudlarking?
What is mudlarking?
When I saw it, it made me think along the lines of ideas of the primordial soup, really, as a kind of generative, originary point of life. If I could imagine the primordial soup from which everything came, it would be this kind of slimy, turbid, muddily dense kind of liquid through which bubbles are pushed, and in the interface between air and matter, you get the production of kind of chemical reactions that then generate the incipient life forms in some sort of way.
When I thought about London, I thought about the Thames. I just love the fact that there's this space where you can rest your eye on the in the distance. It makes a difference to me, that sort of horizon looking like being out at sea. I love the movement of the tides and the feeling of the tides. I like the different textures of the different parts of foreshore. It's not all the same. There are parts where there's the most gloopy mud and you sink into it, and there's hard packed mud, and there's pebbles, and there's stretches of sand, and there's rocks. And you learn to read them, and I can now look at an Instagram post that someone else has done, and it might be a tiny square with just an object on a tiny bit of foreshore, and I think, ha, I know where that was taken.
No, I'm okay with mud. The problem is it's the really fine, silty mud that covers everything like icing on a cake, and it's also slippery as hell. So it makes it much harder to find things, and it's you know, you wipe out, you start your morning landing on your butt. It's not a lot of fun, but I'm okay with mud, obviously. I'm down here in it all the time. In fact, my right foot's wet from getting sloshed by one of the boats going by, not paying attention. So I'm obviously okay being dirty. It's just prohibitive, that kind of mud, so.
Should we keep putting water in?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's thickening up already. I'm afraid if we add more mud, then on Monday when I come in, it's going to be a solid block. And you won't be here to help me.
So there's this artwork by Robert Rauschenberg from the late 60s called Mud Muse, and it's quite a large container which is filled with a very specific type of mud or clay, which is quite slimy, has a certain liquidity and a certain viscosity, and underneath it are some pumps which send out compressed air, and these are responding to an external unit, which is a reel-to-reel tape recorder with music on it, or with sounds on it, and these sounds kind of come down the wires, and the pumps respond to the different types of sound with different reactions, and this sends these waves of air up through the mud, so it's constantly sort of burping and producing sort of circles from within itself, and you hear the music sort of filtered through this, but also the sound of the mud itself, and it just sort of goes on unpredictably. And apparently it's the case that this is a really complex mechanism that Rauschenberg put together with the external part and the air pumps and how you calibrate the sound and also the specific type of mud clay that you need, which has to be of a really particular consistency to respond to the sound waves. And currently there's just one man called Gunnar in Stockholm, in the Museum of Modern Art there, who knows how to set it and calibrate it and look after it and coax it and produce the mud to the right consistency. Now, he's been looking after it since 2007 when the previous custodian died suddenly. But whenever this piece is shown around the world, they have to bring in the technician to set it up and look after it for the duration.
It's an old term. It used to be many years ago, Victorian times and older, people used to come down on Thames, pick up bits of coal, stuff like that, so they could sell it to poor people, way of them earning money, really. So, yeah.
A brief history of mudlarking. It's an old term. The exact origins are not known, so far as I'm aware. But certainly it was in use in the 18th and 19th centuries, not necessarily just describing what I think is the stereotypical image of a small child hunting on the Thames foreshore for scrap, but much more widely applicable to people of all ages, and men and women, who really were part of the scavenger class that inhabited London. In those days, who, when the tide was out on the River Thames, would go down to the foreshore and look for anything that had any resellable value, bits of old rope, bits of wood. They were notorious for hanging around boat builders' yards looking for, you know, copper rivets, which then, as now, copper has a great value. But also mudlark was used as a term to describe people who would try and cajole passers-by, people getting onto boats out of a penny or a halfpenny for something performance-related, fighting in the mud, just anything that attracts attention and could get a little coin tossed in their direction.
I've had gold posy rings, I've had pilgrim badge, I've had loads of coins.
One of my favourite objects are pins. I've been collecting them for 6 years and I've got about 15,000 of them, which is quite obsessive. But there's something really amazing about a very wide foreshore and being able to squat down and then just see something very, very small. And what's incredible about them is that they're very ordinary objects, but when you research them, you discover all these things about ordinary people. Queen Elizabeth I had a royal pin maker, and the Elizabethans had ruffs with hundreds of pins, and women sometimes used to prick men with pins to keep off unwanted advances. And then papers were kept together with pins, and shrouds were kept together with pins. And originally it was a cottage industry with people straining their eyes making them, and then it turned into a production line, which was written about by Adam Smith and became quite famous, and then they were factory produced.
Mudlarks like their own different things. Some like trade tokens, some like coins, some like the silver hammer coins. It's everyone's got their own real interest, really. So
what's your cup of tea?
I do like the old trade tokens. I do like the clay pipes as well, the complete ones.
Little glass buttons called prunts that in the 17th century were attached to the stems of heavy wine glasses. And they come in different forms. Some have like a sharp spiral of glass. And there's another type called a raspberry prunt, which looks like a raspberry. It's dimpled. And there would have been 10 of these on the stem of a wine glass. And they provided an aesthetic attraction. They were practical in that before forks, you know, people had greasy hands and they'd stop you from dropping your wine glass.
Everyone who goes down to the foreshore for the first time is hoping to find a clay pipe. So these clay pipes are like the cigarettes of yesteryear, and they are remarkable. They came to England in about 1580 with tobacco. So they're based on basically on a Native American design. And you can date them from the size of the bowl and the length of the stem. I'm holding one in my hand that I found about a year and a half ago. And it's 250 years old. I think the stem's about 10 inches long. It's remarkable it survived with this lovely little bowl on the end. And people used to smoke all the time. After it was introduced and filtered down through the court of Elizabeth I, it soon reached the general population. And so men and women and children were smoking them. And when you hear the noise on the Thames foreshore, there's like a light tinkling sound. There used to be one spot in particular which sounded like the wind chimes. The tide would come in and the broken pipe stems would all clatter against each other like old bones and make the most delicious noise. I absolutely loved it. That little cache of pipe stems has unfortunately gone. And I've collected, I'm quite a Puritan now. The pipe bowl has to be complete and there has to be some length on the stem. So I've got about 500 of them. They're in quite good condition and some of them are decorated. And I think of them as the fag ends of yesteryear. I sort of think of them as like cigarette butts chucked by a bus stop today. You might find these in areas where there were lots of people, like ferry stops or at the bottom of stairs, often buried, always a delight to find.
Many of the spoils in the Thames owe their existence, at least indirectly, to the violence of colonialism. As Joseph Conrad writes in Hearts of Darkness, they had sailed from Deptford, from Greenwich, from Erith, the adventurers and the settlers, king's ships and the ships of men on change, captains, admirals, the dark interlopers of the Eastern trade, and the commissioned generals of East India fleets. Hunters for gold or pursuers of fame, they had all gone out on that stream bearing the sword and often the torch, messengers of the might within the land, bearers of a spark from a sacred fire.
Virtually the whole of the Thames was just like a motorway. Say it's like the M25, because everything would come into London, went out of London, all come up Thames from Roman times. So back in the day, if you look at the old photos, it's like you'd be able to walk across the Thames on the boats where they're so close to each other, because everything come in the Thames through with the boats.
So you can come down, and if you can tune out the Uber boats going by, which is difficult because they're loud, you can kind of connect really with the history, and you can put yourself back very, very far back in time. But you know, conversely, without the boats, we didn't get the churn to push the stuff on shore that you get, because they pick up, as you can hear in the background, quite a weight when they cut through. So it's a bit of a symbiotic relationship, really. Plus, they clear the mud away, the really slippery, ice skatey, slimy stuff in the mornings, without which you wouldn't find anything. So really, it's a love-hate thing with the boats.
Also thinking about ideas of the golem, and this sort of mythical being that's produced from earth and mud, and somehow into that comes the spark of life. And that's an interesting sort of set of motifs, I think, that you can also see in the early thinkings on utopia of Ernst Bloch, where he imagines himself to be this extraordinary vessel that you would put wine in northern Germany, and it has this great big belly. It's a bottle with a big belly, but on its front is the face of a wild man that Bloch imagines dancing with the hares in the moonlight on the heath. And he sort of casts himself into that vessel, which is called a Bartman jug.
And like the best thing about it is you don't know what you don't know. So like yeah. I used to find Bartman faces and not know what they were and give them away to my friends like an asshole. They're like 500 years old faces, pieces of pottery.
Also noticed quite a few people on the foreshore that I've talked to have used mudlarking as a way of moving through their grief. If they've had something happen to them or they're trying to recover, it's quite meditative and calming and you're focused in the moment. And so I'm not saying everybody, it's only a handful, but it has struck me that it's a hobby that is gentle and easy to do, I think. If you're feeling sad, it will soothe your soul in some way, this act of looking and being near water and hearing the waves and finding these objects and having a community of people around you that you can have contact with just by discussing the meaning of a pin or the history of a bit of pottery that you pick up.
But then you step down a few metres to the foreshore when the tide is out, and suddenly everything gets very quiet and you experience a sense of loneliness, and it's transgressive but not too transgressive, and you also have long distances ahead of you.
Yeah, I mean, mud is the medium for archaeology, isn't it? All those layers, which also produces a nice psychic metaphor, Freud as well, but you know, what layer, this sort of sense in which our ground is always sort of growing through our interactions on the ground.
The Dictionary of Symbols describes mud as signifying the union of the purely receptive principle, earth, with the power of transition and transformation, water. Mud is regarded as the typical medium for the emergence of matter of all kinds. Plasticity is therefore one of its essential characteristics, and it is related, by analogy, with biological processes and nascent states. In other words, mud acts as a filthy midwife for the cornucopia of life that erupts onto the earth's surface. If earth is the life-giving of the four elements, then mud is like its placenta. According to Gaston Bachelard, the desire to dig in the earth immediately takes on a new aspect, a new duality of meaning, if the ground is muddy.
I was really struck by these lines in Walter Benjamin's 1933 essay, Experience and Poverty, where he's thinking about the impact of war and what changes in the environment. And it's about the impact of technology on the environment. But he begins that essay with a story, a fable that he thinks is really rich, which is the famous fable of the farmer and the three sons, who says, somewhere on this land buried in the mud is a treasure, go out and find it. But you know, and they go out and they dig and they dig and they find nothing. But of course, in the next season, all the plants grow from the land, and the treasure was their work converted into the fertility of land. And that is wisdom. And Benjamin says, we have no wisdom anymore, and effectively that muddy field is now the battlefield, and it's trenches, you know, it's been dug out for purposes of death and exposure to technology.
Tide. I'm aware of the dangers of somebody slipping or slipping and the tide coming in and nobody seeing you. I know that it's sort of, it's not going to stop. It's not going to stop for you if you fall. It's going to cover you. I'm aware of that. And I'm aware of the mud that can suck. My main image of the river is of this trench, really, with a deeper part, very still on top, and these big container ships as you go further out, just moving down it very, very slowly. It feels quite, looks quite sluggish.
The wallet from a German tourist who had been pickpocketed, and the wallet had been stripped of cash and thrown in the river. But when I picked it up, it still had all her personal photographs, which she didn't have anymore, like old photos of her dad and stuff like that. And it also had her address, so I was able to return it to her. And from that came a really lovely friendship and connection. That wouldn't survive into the future. You know, you don't find things that will rot away so easily. Now, the mud is incredible for preservation. You know, once you're in that anoxic mud, not a lot changes, but you know, a leather wallet and photographs, I don't think are going to survive.
I mean, I find I go onto the estuary quite a lot, and there are areas there where there's just so much plastic washed up. It actually looks quite beautiful from a distance because it's incredibly colourful. So it looks like a smashed up rainbow. And then you look at it closely and there's just an abundance of lighters. I don't know why there's so many lighters.
I don't think that mudlarking is infinite. Eventually, you can find everything. And I hear people saying that you find a lot less now because it's so much more popular as an activity. So yes, I think it's possible to find it all. It's interesting the way the foreshore works. You can, the foreshore is being rapidly eroded, possibly due to the Thames clippers, and you can get down to a level of ground which predates major urbanization of London. So you can get down to Bronze Age mud. And there are still, you know, there are like bits of tree roots growing there. And you might find a, you know, a sort of Anglo-Saxon fish trap. And you certainly find lithic objects, you know, you find stone tools. But once you've gone older than that, it's all gone.
And at the beginning, 6 years ago, there weren't that many people mudlarking. I think there were only a couple of hundred licenses. So when you went down to the foreshore, maybe you'd meet one or two regulars. Often there'd be people who'd been doing it for 10 or 20 years. So they were older men. And it was a very, very small community. You kind of know everybody. And over the years, it's grown. I think there are now several thousand license holders. And that's largely because it's become popular I mean, before, if I told someone I mudlarked, they would invariably look completely puzzled. And now I saw an article in a paper recently saying it's a new trend amongst Londoners. So because it's become popular, the demographics changed. I think there's a lot more women coming down, and it's moved away from the hardcore sort of, it was associated with sort of men with metal detectors and a lot of years of graft, and it's moved away from that to a much more generalised hobby and more of a cross-section of Londoners. Now, I'd love to find a 19th century syphilis syringe, which would have been inserted into some man's penis and then a bit of mercury shot up it. I would be delighted. And I wonder often, do you think, would I be delighted by a plastic Tampax applicator? Do you know what? Probably I would be in 150 or 200 years. I think, wow, is that how people managed it? That's so interesting.
What do you find that's contemporary, or what is the future? I guess what you're asking there is, what are we losing today that will be found in 500 years' time? And what will survive? I mean, unfortunately, plastic survives really, really well. And I think there will be an awful lot of plastic objects still around in half a millennium.
Mudlarkers often place their pursuit in the mythology of the archetypal lost treasure haul. For those around Deptford, the wreck of the Golden Hind is the touchstone of this Atlantean booty, thought to be resting somewhere in the centuries-old mud of an older iteration of Deptford Creek. The old creek is the key to finding the ship, but it was filled in during the 19th century and its exact location has been forgotten. This creek was on the site of what was the Tudor Royal Navy Dockyard. This was the old creek's most probable location due to a curious zigzag boundary line separating Deptford and Lewisham. The boundary line makes no sense in the modern layout of streets, parks and buildings, but it does if it is the bed of the ancient creek, because such waterways were frequently used for such boundaries. However, in May 2009, new evidence came to light suggesting the site lay inside the ruins of Convoy's Wharf, with old structures remaining on the riverbank. On the upside of the river, the structures are river stairs that were more than likely built from the bed of the creek to save from excavation. Perhaps the 2020s will reveal the lost site of the wreck, as the Convoy's Wharf site is soon to be developed. As finds dwindle on the foreshore, the large consortiums of opportunistic property developers might prove to be more adept at finding the Mudlarker's Holy Grail than anyone with a spade. But perhaps the myth will persist in eternity, beckoning new generations down to Deptford's beach.
There is a moment in a late interview with John Ashbery where he is quoted laughing, "I don't have anything against mud. I'm working on my next book, Selected Later Poems, and while working on it, I came across a poem where I have talked about mud. Can't remember which one, but the line was something like, 'And what about mud? If we lose it, we lose everything. Distinctions would no longer get muddied. There'd be nothing in life to wriggle out of, no ooze to drop back into. We need water, heaven knows. But mud, it's so all over the place.'"
Because essentially, we too are made of minerals. We too come from the mud. We live on the mud. This is our ground, and we at some point must have emerged in some way from it, and so we carry it within us.
Woolwich Pier, beneath a big crane standing, and oh, the love I felt for her, it passed all understanding. took a sailing on the river flow, sweet river flow. London town was mine to give her, sweet Thames flow softly. Made the Thames into a crown, flow, sweet river flow. Made a brooch of silver town, sweet Thames flow softly.